Okay, we're back again. Everybody knows who we are, so we can start talking. Hello, gentlemen.
How are you doing?
Hello.
Are we sure everybody knows who we are? This is only the second episode. Okay.
I know who we are. That's good enough for me. Okay, I'm Jim Menick.
I'm John Cruz.
And I'm Mike Beats.
And we're the Monkees.
Now we're losing the audience here, Jim Menick. All right.
Okay. Well, we'll just move right along. Okay, this is our second episode of The View from Tab. Last week we talked about case disclosures, and we had a little bit of technology on Instapaper and talked about some other things. We're just going to take it from there. We do have a blog website if you want to comment on what we're talking about, which is theviewfromtab.blogspot.com. You can check it out there, or you can subscribe on iTunes to The View from Tab. Okay, we already sort of thought we would talk tonight about the new resolution, but before we get to the new resolution, I'd want to bring up one thing, and I actually mentioned it in my blog, and I think this is a good point, because I was talking to Joe Vaughn about our last week and case disclosure and stuff like that. And he had a real objection to the word openness as an overall shell for the discussion. And I can understand why, because if in fact you disagree with any of this, that means that you are against openness. And by definition, by default, whatever, who would be against openness? That sounds like a bad thing. And I think maybe a better word for the whole concept is transparency, or maybe there's another word like transparency, but if you cast it in that light and say, okay, this is going to be open or you're going to be closed, it does have a bad sound to me. I was just wondering what you two thought about that.
You can go first, John.
Okay. I think that's a fair point. I think especially because the one problem with the debate, I think, over case disclosure is that it's not really a cut and dry issue, in the sense that some people who are opposed to the case list, as was coordinated at Greenhill or as has been proposed elsewhere, are for some sort of form of disclosure, like let's release our citations, let's release something else. And I guess it's fair to say that there are reasons to be opposed to a case list that perhaps go beyond issues of being open or closed about information. I mean, maybe I'm off on that.
To me, those things seem the same. I don't know if anyone wants to be accused of being non-transparent. Saying someone is non-transparent even sounds more sinister than not open. But whatever. Okay. To me, the people that are on quote unquote that side can call it what they want. I guess I can see how there's just different levels of openness. I guess I agree with John that it's not necessarily cut and dry with openness, but transparency to me is a fine term for it, because I think that in terms of even last year at the TOC, I argued that people should be completely transparent with what their conflicts are, their conflicts of interest in judging, their who they've coached with before, who they've cut cards for before, who they've done case writing with before, etc. So
what you just said just brings up a whole thing. I have been in an awful lot of tab rooms, and I have very seldom seen anybody really block themselves against kids that they may have trained in the past or something like that. I don't see what I would consider enough of that. I mean, just truth to tell.
I agree
with that, and I think to me it's all Maybe I try to fit things in a system a little bit too much, but to me it all is all part of a system of the backroom dealings and all the stuff that goes on. Well, it could be completely innocent too, and people just might not know that they're supposed to, disclose those sorts of things. And I think tournaments should probably have more explicit policies about that as well.
It'd be nice if we could actually, when you were at the TOC, did they actually come up with something that would be a policy that we could put forward?
Well, I think that again, I think Aaron Timmons and I sort of spearheaded a lot of the effort along with Dave Houston and I'm not exactly sure who else was involved, but that seemed to cause a lot of controversy too, where people were asked to recuse themselves against people, and some of the judges said, well, I can't judge these 25 people, and they just went overboard. And they said that they did that on purpose, that they purposely...
And I just can't conceive of that. I mean, of course it happened, but what I find interesting is right now I've been entering all the judges for the Bronx Science Tournament coming up. And it's interesting to find all these conflicts because I find that the idea of having all of these different kinds of conflicts, like the shadow coaching, one-on-one coaching, et cetera, is way more prevalent, at least in the LD pool at my tournament, than it is in the policy pool. And I find that kind of interesting as well.
Well, I think LD lends itself a little bit more. I mean, Lexi Green always talks about the lone debater and things like that too, and how, you know, they need to... That you know, the Bay Area has a lot of lone debaters, and I think that, or some people call them lone wolf debaters or whatever. And it seems to me that that is something that is much more possible in Lincoln Douglas debate than it is in other types of, or at least in policy debate, because, you know, it doesn't take two people. You can just sort of do it on your own. Tournaments let you sort of enter on your own. You don't really need a coach to, once you know how to do it, you don't need a school administrator necessarily or a school coach to do it. So the barrier to entry into Lincoln Douglas debate is a lot lower than it is even in, I would even think, public forum debate, just because you don't need a partner.
Yeah, I just took in somebody right before this call. You know, I know who this person is, and I know that they're, you know, official, so to speak, but they are by themselves. And they've also, I know, worked with various coaches and whatnot. So, yeah, I mean, it's a issue that comes up. Anyway, one of the things that we did promise that we would talk about the new resolution, and I would like to do that and make that our main subject for today. And I spent some time today looking up things like biopower and stuff like that. But if there is anyone possibly listening to this who doesn't know what next month's or the November-December topic is, resolved public health concerns justify compulsory immunization. So, as I would like to talk about this, I'm just going to start this off with one thing, because I was talking to Vaughn about this before the NFL finals, because there is a very, very good This American Life piece that it was back in December, and it puts two opposing forces together, and one of them is people who are afraid, parents who are afraid of measles vaccinations, because there is apparently a very small chance of side effects, and the other side being, of course, people who are afraid of the measles. I mean, we forget, because measles isn't particularly prevalent because of the immunization, that measles is actually can be a deadly disease. Sure. And apparently there was some instances in California. Where else would there be instances like this, where in fact there was a death from measles because somebody refused to have their kids immunized. Boy, this is going to be fun listening to other people say that. If I can't say immunized, then I don't know if anybody else can. But, so that to me, when I look at this in that very straightforward framework, I see a very old-fashioned kind of LD topic where you very much have an individual's concerns versus social concerns.
Definitely.
And in the most equal way. I mean, it's like almost the numbers. I'm sure if you look at these numbers, they're probably somewhat different, but they're probably close enough to say it's similar, that, you know, it's six of one, half a dozen another. So what is the, you know, the thing that has to be done? I like looking at, I don't know if people argue about it that way, but that to me certainly is a good starting point for thinking about this topic.
I definitely agree. I actually think this is an awesome topic. I think it's one of the coolest topics that I've seen come out in a little while. I think it talks about both an important issue, obviously with the H1N1 stuff and the fear over that. I mean, I don't necessarily think that that's what our number one public health concern should be, but obviously health issues are in the public eye, so it makes sense that this resolution would come up. I think that it talks about a lot of essential issues to LD. You know, up in the Northeast, Jim and I are working now on the modest novice topic, and one of our goals in picking a topic that was specifically for novices was to have to guarantee that we were going to have a resolution that talked about some core basic things for LD. And I think this resolution actually talks about a lot of those core basic things, right? I mean, because you could be talking about you could have the most critical literature and have really awesome and topical cases, but you could also have the most traditional of arguments related to the purpose of the state and the state's relationship with the individual. I think it's great. I think it's an awesome topic.
Yeah, but I would have said that exact same thing, that if this were the modest novice topic, I'd be happy with it.
Definitely. I mean, I think it the other thing I think is great about this topic is that I mentioned briefly the critical literature, and what I think is cool about that is that I think I've said this for a long time. I mean, I increasingly see myself as a dinosaur of sorts with certain things about LD, but with critical literature, I do think it's important for kids to be exposed to it, and I think that there's very topical stuff to discuss on here that I guess would be called critical or postmodern or whatever. But I think that's great because it's very accessible literature, right? And it's literature that makes sense and makes sense to individual people. I mean, with all the discussion we're having now about universal health care and the government's role in ensuring its citizens' health, I think that it's great that we're having a topic that discusses this kind of stuff.
I think that the context, if I have any problem with the resolution, I guess it's the lack of context given to it. I think public health concerns is such a vague concept that I'm not really sure. You know, I'm afraid that the debates are going to just turn into in classical LD sense, a debate about whether we're giving the government a blank check to immunize its citizens, and whether or not there actually has to be, like, whether it can be some trumped up public health concern that the government just says, or is it an actual public health concern? I'm also curious a little bit about just to back up a little bit, what do they have in mind when they talk about public health concerns, do you think? Because, and also, I guess I should also say that when it's compulsory immunization, it's rare that compulsory immunization would be, for example, in the United States, the entire citizenry wouldn't be, it would be localized, right? It would be a specific area where there has been an outbreak of a specific thing? Or do you think it's a sense of emergency sort of thing, or is it not a sense of emergency sort of thing?
I think it could be, I mean, I guess it could be either. You're right that the lack of context can be a little frustrating. I mean, I think what's interesting to think about, and I don't mean to stray from your question because I think this is related, but it's also interesting to consider what kind of mindset the government would need to have in order to believe that it can override, I guess, the rights of the citizens. I don't know. I'm sort of rambling, but the point being that I don't know. I guess I think that the resolution, because it doesn't have a context, I suppose that there will be framework debates over what the context of it is. But I think that the issue is debatable whether it's on a national scale or a local scale, right?
I think that in a modern Lincoln Douglas debate, I think the resolution is going to be parametricized by the affirmative to be a specific outbreak, disease thing. There's going to be some analysis of the probability of that happening, right? And then a huge amount of impact to a pandemic, right? I would think
this is definitely be big impacts kind of research. I'm sorry, go on with what you're saying.
I would think that that's going to be the typical affirmative case, either it's going to be specific and parametricized, or I think the other way that people will probably do it is whether or not the government, just more of a government, a contracts case that says that if we trust the government to save us from, or to provide a military, to provide a police, to provide a, you know, to be able to have martial law, to do other things to protect us from outside forces, then it would necessarily follow that a government should be there to protect us from possible pandemic or epidemic situations.
And of course, we forfeit certain, like, just like we forfeit certain rights to the police, to the military for their protection. We need to forfeit certain rights. I guess the right to, you know, control of our own body, to be protected from health problems.
Right, and you know, and the other thing that happens with compulsory immunization is I've done no research on the issue of what happens if someone refuses. Right.
Right.
In the case of, I would think, in the case of like parents not wanting their children to be immunized for certain things, the impact is potentially death. But are there in which the parent could then be, you know, held responsible for that? But is there in modern day if there's an outbreak of something in Los Angeles and I refuse to get immunized, do I get taken off to jail or do I don't really know what happens. And it also seems to me that the immunization is usually some sort of step that you have to take in order to do something else. Like all children, in order to access some public good, like all children in order to attend school have to get these shots. People returning from certain right. countries after traveling have to take these shots. Immunization is compulsory in the sense that anyone that wants to have access to those public goods have to take it, but it's not compulsory in the sense that every citizen has to do it.
Well, the diseases that we're talking about, I mean, there's a wide variety of diseases. I'm more inclined to want to talk about the diseases that exist rather than the diseases that potentially exist. So, I mean, like I said, measles is a perfectly good example of a disease that exists and a disease that's absolutely deadly. I mean, it certainly kills unborn children, right? I mean, this is one of the things that we're pretty good, or at least it deforms unborn children. I may be wrong. I know German measles does that. I'm not sure if regular measles has that same thing. But we know that it is a disease that kills. We know that it's a disease you can't get if you've been immunized against it. And, you know, so in New York, I know you don't let kids into the schools, right. But I don't think that getting into the schools and not being able to participate in the benefit of schooling is really the issue so much as that's just the way they make you do it because they have to enforce it somehow and they have no other way to do it. But that's sort of an indirect aspect of it. And the real issue is they don't want people getting measles, and, you know, because measles will make you, you know, could, I mean, you know, 90% or 99% of the people who get measles, or probably even more than 99% of the people who get measles recover from it. It's unpleasant, you know, but they recover from it and they're fine afterwards. As is the same case with the people who get a measles vaccination, they recover from it. But, you know, there is that very small percentage that don't. So these are, to me, that's a direct conflict. And the other things are just sort of ancillary to it.
What's the conflict? I mean, what does the negative say to measles?
That you don't want your child being exposed to a direct cause of potential disease, which would be getting that shot. And this is, I mean, one thing, we have to say this because people are going to bring this up and I would cringe at the thought. But the people that are going to bring up the whole autism right. thing, well, that, which is yeah. scientifically unproven, if not actually disproven. And I think that's just going to drive people nuts for 2 months.
They're going to find evidence that says it's true because there are wackos who think it is true.
They're going to use that what's her name person that wrote all the books, the Playboy bunny or whatever, whose kid is autistic. But sure, and her kid is Jenny something.
Jenny McCarthy. Yeah. Jenny McCarthy. Jim Carrey's girlfriend or wife. Anyway, I think yesterday we were doing some research at practice, and I think that there has been one instance where someone did not have symptoms of autism prior to getting shots. They got some shots and then the symptoms of autism showed up. And I think that whoever got sued did end up settling. But they
always say, I mean, all malpractice gets settled.
Right. But
that's beside the point. The causality there is no causal link between these shots and autism. Most autism happens to show itself. It happens to manifest at the age when people are getting the shots. Yeah. That doesn't mean the shots caused it.
Yeah, I think pretty careful reading of even the literature on it would just indicate that there's no causation and on that too.
Anyhow, like I said, we think we just had to bring that up because it's going to be the unfortunate gorilla in a number of debate rooms as it goes on.
At first glance of the resolution, the critical eye in me says, of course, I believe the negative. I don't think anyone should be forced to be given shots ever. At the same time, when you think about it further, the public concern of people not getting immunized is huge, and the impacts are huge. And in a world where we are consistently giving up rights for a greater good, the amount of disease that is prevented from immunization, what can the negative say back? One, either being critical, or if someone chooses not to have a critical slant on it, why? From a rights perspective, does someone have a right to say no to something like that without there being implication? And can the negative defend almost a civil disobedience position, saying, no, I'm not going to get immunized, and I will take the punishment that comes with that?
I mean, you raise a good question, because, I mean, I would imagine that most good, experienced debaters, will take a sort of critical approach to the negative, because I think it may be the strongest negative case, because the other things are okay. I mean, if I'm going to give this to my novices who are going to debate this for 1 month, yeah, they're going to debate it at a very civil disobedience level because they'll have learned that language. But in the real world, I don't think that's necessarily true. I just am not persuaded by, you know, the agent of the government and somebody trying to gain power over my body by doing this, because the power that they're gaining is at best for my own good, and at best for the good of everybody. And it's a shot, you know, I mean, it's like, I get shots all the time. I mean, I just got a flu shot, which is why I was in a haze all weekend. I got a flu shot, presumably, so I wouldn't get the flu. I get the measles shot, so I don't get them. I don't get the measles shot so that you don't get the measles. I get the measles shot so that I don't get the measles. So, I mean, a lot of my motivation for doing any of this stuff is, in fact, personal. Sure. To begin with. Would not be my favorite arguments, but one could conceivably make that kind of Millesian argument that you're doing this, you know, for yourself and could be forced to do something for yourself.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I guess if it's something just for myself, then I guess I think the negative has stronger positions. But if there's actual public health, you know, concerns about things, then I think that the negative position becomes a little more tenuous.
There's a thing going on, and I've been posting a lot of stuff in my feed blog about it, with the National Institute of Health, but that doesn't sound right to me. But anyhow, it's not forcing, but pretty much as close as you can get to forcing circumcision in Africa. Mm-hmm. because it'll prevent STDs later on,
right?
Kind of thing. Now, obviously, it's not an immunization, or if it is, I don't want it at the moment. But nonetheless, it's the same concept. So conceptually, it's the same thing. And the problem is the person who hasn't gotten... Well, here, at least I'll know who that person is. I can see that fairly clearly if somebody hasn't been circumcised. But, if it's just a shot, if somebody's just didn't get the shot, there's no way for anyone else to know this. We don't have any particular controls that we can enforce.
Well, I mean, that may or may not be true. I mean, you have to show, to gain access to certain things in society, you have to show that you have these... that you've passed these steps.
Right, like right. To work at Bronx Science, I had to show that I had vaccinated. Wow, I really can't say the word either. Show that I've been vaccinated and provide proof of it, right? I mean, there are forms that you have to fill out to show these kinds of things.
You didn't have to be circumcised.
You did not have to prove circumcision.
just checking. I mean, I know the Bronx is unusual.
I was going to make a joke, but then I realized it was insensitive. But then again, I had a bar mitzvah, so I could have made the joke I was going to make. But anyway, back to the subject.
So what? I still am at a loss of what the negative does on this topic, outside of being, you know, critical. Because I even think when you are weighing the another example that we thought of at practice, and I think probably a lot of people thought of right off the bat, was just this issue of bioterrorism and, you know, there being this state of emergency where, you know, we need to immunize people so that there's not this rapid spreading of whatever has been released into the into the water or into the atmosphere or whatever, right? What is, I mean, how, I don't, I'm at a loss of how a negative or smallpox or, you know, any of those things, how a negative can respond to those things and have some sort of offense, besides being critical, on it. Should we define what we mean by critical? John, do you want to do that? Like what, you're a little more of a Foucault guy than I am. And, so you might be able to,
Well, I think that a lot of those kinds of terms are sort of bandied about, right? I mean, Foucault probably didn't see himself as a critical – I mean, I guess what we call critical in debate is confusing because a lot of times people just associate critical with critique with a K, right? So like sometimes they even spell as critical with a K. I guess the easiest way to define critical theory, and it's not a very easy thing to define, is to say that it's a general critique of culture and society. It tends to draw not just from traditional philosophy, but also from the humanities and the social sciences. There's a reason, for example, that a lot of critical theorists are literary critics. Menick likes to point out a lot that Zizek is a film critic, as I recall from your talks, Jim, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or that you know, that Baudrillard wasn't a traditional philosopher in a sense. So I guess a lot of the critical literature and debate seeks to undermine sort of traditional notions of relationships between the government and the governed in this case. One example would be Foucault. You mentioned Foucault. So obviously Foucault talks about biopower. Foucault also questions the relationship between medical authorities and the individual. He likens them to to priests and to confession. And I find that those kinds of criticisms can be really interesting because it sort of causes you to rethink assumptions that you might normally have about the resolution as posed, right? Like most people would just say that the government has the proactive responsibility to defend its citizens, like we were talking about before in the contractual case, right? But a more critical lens, a more postmodern lens, might, you know, challenge traditional notions of authority, point out injustices that exist, criticize modern corporate capitalist state, things like that.
Well, I mean, the Foucault argument is going to say that this is, you know, allowing the government to have a power over my body that is just at a level beyond the acceptable. And, you know, for whatever reason, and that power is meaningful in and of itself in a bad way.
Right. And just to sort of add to that, I mean, one of the reasons that Foucault's insights were considered so groundbreaking is that he made arguments that talked basically about how traditionally, and discipline and punish makes this argument, but also the history of sexuality where he introduced the idea of biopower. He made arguments that traditionally government authority rested on its power to control death, right? Like that it was the ultimate enforcer of the law. But nowadays, increasingly, we see that the government has control over life, right? Has control over aspects of our life that we might not be so comfortable with if we sat down and thought about them critically, right? And certainly
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, certainly the idea that that the government can control your personal health might be something to give you pause, especially if, yes, the government might have an overriding concern in its own eyes to guarantee people's safety, but their personal health, you know, something that might not be a perfect analog.
But, yeah, especially if you take into consideration, you know, I read something that said that, you know, every single immunization that the Merck drug company has put forward based on their research has gotten the CDC approval, right? That when you put pharmaceuticals into the mix and the amount of lobbying power that they have,
right,
and the amount of science that they create and the amount of, you know, just how much power pharmaceuticals have in getting bills passed and getting patents made and therefore creating new diseases and new vaccines for those new diseases.
Right. It's funny that
adds another element.
Yeah, it's just funny that you should mention that because I know this is going to be a bizarre statement, but what you just said reminded me of when people make jokes about how Listerine invented gingivitis, right? Like the idea that when you rely on the science of the company that's producing the product to combat the disease or so-called disease, that's a bit suspect, right? I mean, it'll be interesting to see how debaters deal with that, right? Because increasingly, and I think for the better, debaters like to press each other on evidence. I think that's important, and I think that's a good thing. And it's going to be interesting because so much of the evidence that'll be about the scientific nature of these diseases will probably be underwritten by the drug companies that are purporting to challenge those diseases, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we were just in some initial research yesterday. We were finding that something like a child before the age of 3 or 5 is now taking 4 times the number of immunizations that they took even since 1983.
Right. I mean,
there's something, and I don't know if there's any relationship with this, but one thing that's very clear is that kids nowadays are allergic to everything.
Yeah. Right.
When
I was a kid, nobody was allergic to anything. I mean,
peanuts.
If you had somebody who was allergic, I mean, peanuts, they made you eat peanuts when I was a kid. You know, yeah. I mean, the nuns made you eat peanuts. It was like the way it worked. And nowadays, forget it. I mean, like, and these things have come in a way from the medical world that we have created and the antibacterial world that we have created and things like that. So at some point, you know, there is a demonstrable, you can actually see it, evidence that shows that we haven't necessarily done a good job with controlling public health.
In fact,
we've just created other diseases. So can't I make my own decisions about what diseases I want to get? Because I'm going to get something. Because you're showing me that I have no choice but to get something. So why should the government make that choice when I ought to be able to make that choice for myself?
But when there's evidence that would show that, promoting constant use of a certain vaccine can actually cause a strengthened strain of the disease to come out, right? Shouldn't that give us pause to have compulsory immunization, right?
I mean, all your antibiotics.
Right. Yeah. So the belief that that the government should therefore just force everyone to be vaccinated may actually end up reinforcing the problem that they're trying to challenge in the first place, right? Something that one might want to consider when constructing case positions.
Yeah, I think I see a little more of the negative side of things now too. But in the face of where there is actual hard science on something, I think the negative is going to be in a tough position to overcome that.
And I think Beetz is right about the postmodern and critical literature. I mean, this reminds me a lot of a topic that I had probably unsurprisingly pushed for that didn't get selected a couple of years back about gender categorization in schools. The reason it reminds me of that is because had that topic been chosen, I think that coaches and students, regardless of their personal philosophy about LD debate and the LD canon and whatnot, really would have had to confront critical literature, right? I mean, there's no way you could debate that resolution without coming across some critical literature. And it strikes me that And I apologize, I sort of give a rambling overview of postmodernism and critical theory, but it strikes me that debaters will have to confront those kinds of positions here on any kind of
circuit. If students have to go to Foucault, if Foucault has to be accepted as part of the canon of LD, that is a good thing.
I completely agree.
I think there are few people that I would say that about of the 20th century, but there's no question that he is one of them. I mean, he's not an easy writer necessarily, but he's not a terrifically hard writer either. And I think a lot of what he says is fairly clear, but it's work.
I agree.
It's work for people. But I'm fine with Foucault, and I'm fine with even just the when you distill out the concepts of power, even if that's not exactly what he's saying, that material is still good material.
Yeah.
It's intuitively accurate. So applying this to a lot of cases is not a terrible thing.
I would jump in and just say that if there are people listening who are not as familiar with Foucault, there are a couple of books that I think are of interest, right? Clearly, the discussion of biopower and the history of sexuality is a really important piece of writing for debaters to grapple with. The problem is that it's a little abstract, and it also comes at the end of a book that would seem to have little relationship to the topic at hand. Other books like The Birth of the Clinic and things like that, I think, may shed a lot of light on this topic. Also, one book that I think is one of the most eminently readable philosophy books of the 20th century is Discipline and Punish, which is just a good introduction to Foucault in general and an engaging book. I mean, I think that for those of you who have read it, I think most people would agree that the opening chapter on being drawn in quarters is one of the most disturbing things ever. I mean, it's unbelievably well written and just compelling. And
there was just an article, and I don't know if I put it in the feed or not, but just about the guy who got thrown in quarters.
I mean, I remember reading that thing, what the hell is this book, right? And it was great. And actually, I think debaters will find that whether or not they agree with what Foucault says, the fact that he's such a heavily cited author should be an indication that, okay, this is a guy we have to go to, right?
Yeah, he stands up. He's not a nut
job. Yeah, definitely
job. Not. He's
he was a nut
thing.
Job, but not his writing. I agree.
He's our kind of nut job.
But yeah, I think I think it's a good, I agree completely, and I would also say that for those who characterize Mr. Menick as a more quote unquote traditional coach and judge, the fact that he's just said what he said should be an indication that you probably should check out Michelle.
Or that I'm not telling you.
On the other side, I mean, I think that we would – on the other side, there's classical freedom of religion type arguments you can make too, right?
Yeah, that's one thing I'd like to touch before we get off this subject, which is the religion arguments, because I don't know what that's all about at all. So what is the religious issues that play into this?
There's a desecration of body argument, right? Like the idea that isn't that? I mean, I'll confess to you. Here's my atheism comes out. I really don't know a lot about this either. I know that the Christian Science movement is against this kind of stuff, right?
That's okay. Right. It's the I think the Christian Scientists and maybe Jehovah's Witnesses.
Oh, Jehovah's Witnesses, right?
Are probably. You know, would be against this vaccination. I mean, I'm very unfamiliar with the religious aspects of it. I think that it's probably twofold. It's both the desecration of the body, and then also the God will
protect
sort
me,
of
right.
belief too.
But at least but at least we know which religious people can go look
sure,
up
sure.
as a starting
That's
point.
Right.
Because I mean, certainly, if you have the government up against religion at any point, then you've got a pretty interesting conflict.
I would be interested in also seeing if people are going to start talking about like Eastern or alternative medicines on this topic. It seems to me that whether you think that's a good argument or not, that people are likely to run this.
I wish we had the video. We need the video. You need to see the expression on my face when you said that. I hope not.
I'll be honest. I think that sounds like a probably a lame-o kind of argument. At least that's my gut instinct.
Now that you've said it, it'll be out there.
I have a feeling it would have been out there. But just
everything will be out there. We know that. Everything
There's one other thing I want to say about this
later.
Topic. I actually think that and this has nothing to do with the actual arguments at hand, but this is a great November-December topic, in my opinion. And that's because there are not as many tournaments on this topic, and I feel like it's going to feel fresh the entire time. I can see how this topic could maybe feel a little worn out after all, especially if Beats is right and people are going to have these highly parametricized positions that, you know, pose a very specific health threat. That could get tiresome, I think. But I think that having this be the November-December topic, you know, a couple of major tournaments, have you, you know, your Apple Valley. Your
yeah,
Boston,
I mean, essentially
you
have Apple Valley and Glenbrooks, right? And that's pretty – and, you know, so you have some other tournaments, of course, but those
tournament.
Are the big ones.
I'm looking forward to seeing.
Oh, well,
that.
I don't care. Whatever. But I'm just saying, you know, there's yeah, exactly. Because I think you'd wear it out pretty quickly. I don't think it has the durability
sure.
of some others. But I think for a couple of – you know, big tournaments that it'll probably
but
work.
I do want to just say one way. This really is the last thing that I have to say. This is just about the biopower. It is really important. If you are listening to this and you don't know much about that argument, that is an argument to look up. It's the great thing about biopower arguments and about Foucault in general is, first off, Foucault, I think, is pretty readable. But if you have difficulty with him, there are so many books that distill Foucault, that refer to Foucault. I'm looking at my bookshelf right now. Wandering around, as I talk about
this.
And there's just a whole bunch of books that you could Foucault readers and whatnot that you could pick up on this.
Okay, so I think we've dug that into the ground pretty well, but we've talked about a lot of things that give people some starting points or some things to disagree with or some cockamamie stuff to come up against. What we did last week, we did have our little tech topic, and I want to take the tech topic this week, because I've been using this. I have some reservations about it, or maybe more to the point, I have a question about it, but I absolutely love it for the most part, which is this little app for my touch, or if you have an iPhone, called iDebate. And who
it's
wrote
a big,
this?
Big shout out from the View from Tab to Dan Hassin from Milburn High School, who not only wrote it, but just gave it away, right? And I think that's pretty awesome that he put it together. And my understanding is that he's working on another version right now, which is pretty cool.
Good. I mean, what this has, for people who are unfamiliar with it, you should go out and get a touch just so you'll become familiar with it. But one of the things it has there, here on it, first of all, it has, it goes online and gets the latest Victory Briefs daily articles, which people who know me would say, well, that would not be a reason for me to recommend this.
Ouch.
But I actually found myself at Yale going into iDebate to look up stuff that was on Victory Briefs. So, I mean, it is useful for that. If you happen to be in a place where there's wireless and you're sitting around, it's a great way. You can read the whole article. You can read the comments. It updates and so forth and so on. It's very, you know, it's a nice little feature. It has judge paradigms, but I'm questioning, where did these this is my only question about this application, is where do these judge paradigms come from?
Isn't it designed to update from the judge philosophies, Wikispaces? I think the only problem is that And Dan should post a correction on the blog if I'm wrong about this, but I think that it's something like he manually updates it. I don't see how I don't know enough about app design and integration into a Wikispace thing. I don't think it can just randomly pull the things off of Wikispace. Oh, maybe
okay. I say this because I put up a paradigm there. I didn't realize I didn't have a paradigm there, so I put my, you know, two sentences of paradigm in there, and it never got picked up here. So that's my question. Because every year there's a whole bunch of new
and throughout the year
judges, of course, you know.
Throughout the year, I'm planning on updating mine.
Exactly. But then again, not to put too fine a point on it, but at the Yale tournament, which was our first tournament, my kids were using their touch. Sophie had a touch to look up the judges. You know, I mean, it's just really good for
that.
Now, the two other things that it does, one of them, when I was at the round robin at Vassar, of course, everybody times themselves nowadays, so as a judge, you don't really have to pay attention to this, but it has a wonderful timer built in that actually does timing for a debate round, including the prep time, so you can see, you know, countdowns of both the prep time, which is really a nice thing. And the other thing that
this
it has...
This is the coolest part. I know what you're going to say.
This is really the coolest part. So you say that in your tournament, there's 152 people, and there's going to be 6 prelims. So you plug in that information, and it tells you, first of all, how many people are going to be 6-0, how many people are going to be 5-1-4. Now, remember, this is an approximation. It can never be absolutely correct, but over the time, this is going to be pretty close. And that's not because of that's anything. You're predicting a probability, not a definite thing. But anyhow, it gives you those numbers. And then you have to click the little button, and let's see, it also tells
you...
Well,
you're forgetting the hidden feature. It'll tell
you... The hidden
feature,
that's what I'm looking for. Where is that? How do I get that?
Here's what it is. I'm doing this from memory. So what it does is it breaks down the term for you. It says, you know, you'll have... I used this program to determine the breaks for my own tournament, right? So it tells you you're going to have X number of 7-0s, X number of 6-1s, et cetera. But then there's a little tiny arrow, a little arrow in a blue circle... which is next to the numbers, and if you click on that, then it's going to tell you how many of those people will clear out of each thing.
Oh, right, here it is.
Which is great, because that's ultimately the question that kids ask, and at least that's a relevant question. I'm like the kid saying, is this tournament doing high-low speaker points, or is this tournament doing
right, so this says that
power
at,
matching?
At Yale, it says that all 6-0s break, all 5-1s break, and 14-4-2s break. Now, I don't know. That sounds about right to me. I think we broke about 14-15.
Yeah.
At Yale, so it's actually giving you that information.
It is a super awesome program. I think that I think it's the killer app for the iPhone. If you're
finally a reason to get an iPhone.
No, but really, I think it's great. And you know what else I think is great about it? I think it's great that that a debater in the debate community made this and just gave it away. I think it's so cool.
Yeah, well, I'm very thankful myself, and like say, Michael Hassin.
Or Dan Hassin. Michael's his brother.
Dan, I'm sorry, Dan Hassin. Mike, wait,
this is
I'm,
Little
what
Hassin.
Is he right?
This is Little
you
Hassin.
Know? Little Hassin. Okay, that explains why I'm thinking he's Michael, and why I've had Hassins coming to bump as long as I can remember. Because some of these kids, I mean, I've said this before, but some of these kids just seem never to go
away. Sure, and
I
think that's particularly the case.
They're in high school for 40, 50 years.
As a side note, I think Milburn High School has that condition the worst. There have been Hertzes up the wazoo for years. So, but I believe that the design of this program is the last of the Hessines and his classmates with the last of the Hertzes, so it's pretty emotional stuff.
That's good. Okay, so our other what is our other?
So you got predictions.
Well, I don't know what other feature. Predictions. Anybody have a prediction for the weekend?
I predict, I'm sad that I won't be able to be at the tournament in person this year, but I predict that the Kaiser will have an incredible judges' lounge. It tends to have some serious food. So since I can't be there, Matt Dene is going with the Bronx Science Kids, and I have informed him that he has to eat for both of us, which should put some weight on him. That's a good thing.
That's a good thing. There's no question about it that the Monticello High School parents put out the best food around here.
I think so.
For judges only. I mean, the students are eating out of the dorms, but the food for the judges, and of course they're really big with the little tickets. I've been going there now for 20 years. I got to have a little ticket. I know these people. Like Rose Joyce herself is handing out the food. I know you can't have any food. You know, it doesn't. Let me see your ticket.
Pete's been quiet for a while. I want to hear a West Coast prediction.
Yeah, what's going on out west?
Let's see. I predict that. Well, I'm going to talk about baseball because the playoffs have started, and I've been watching the Yankees beat up on the lowly Minnesota Twins. So I predict that by the end, I don't even know what series, but I predict the following winners. I predict the Yankees will beat the Twins in. Well, they'll sweep. I predict that the Phillies will win. I predict that the Red Sox will beat the Angels, and I predict the Dodgers will beat the Cardinals, even though I think the Dodgers are currently... Oh, they just scored. They were behind when I made my prediction.
No wonder he's not saying anything. He's watching baseball while this is going on.
Well, the Dodgers were behind when I made this prediction, but they scored, so I still predict the Dodgers.
There you go.
Be the Dodgers.
Made the
yes, those are my predictions.
Jim, you have a prediction?
Do I have a prediction? I predict that at Monticello, right after we hand out the break round ballots, we will have to stop the round.
Don't say that.
That we will get Matt Thomas to run through the rooms once again. Stop the round.
That was one of the more memorable debate experiences of 08-09, I think.
It was a crusher. One of the things, I mean, we talk about, well, transparency, whatever you want to call it. We did do this at Yale as well. We posted all the results of all the rounds right after the rounds, put them on the walls. Everybody could check them, make sure that what the judges had said was what happened. And, of course, the Yale kids, by the way, were checking all the ballots against the result sheets, too. And by sheer happenstance, we didn't get a lot of mistakes or anything, but we did post all this stuff. It's funny that we posted the brackets when the breaks came out, and some kid comes in and says, the rounds don't have any relationship to the brackets, because they looked at, you know how when you print it out in TRPC, it shows the two together, and so if you don't know what you're looking at, it looks like those people, and I still have that, so you know, for someone who's never seen it before.
Proof that caseless will not, disclosure of caseless will not destroy everything, my JV, one JV kid who cleared and then won his first out round, managed to completely misread the bracket and work with the fellow sophomores, helping out somebody who he wouldn't have hit until he made it to finals if he had made it to finals. So, you know, the human.
Well, he was ready for finals. Yeah, I mean, look on the bright side.
That was very nice of him. But it goes to show you that the human factor will always, I guess, be a factor. I mean, it's a little off the topic of predictions, but just as a last thing, I want to say that I have been pushing for this for years, and I'm glad to see it happening a lot in the Northeast. I think that the posting of the bracket is so great, and I hope that we can talk about that in a future installment, because I think that the reasons for doing something like that are important and worth discussing.
I don't know if I agree with you there, John.
Oh, okay.
I think that the bigger schools will be able to look in the future and see who they'll be hitting.
I wanted to say, again, it'll be a topic, I guess, for another day, but I actually disagree, coming from both as the director of a big school and a kid who debated a very small school, that I think knowing who you can hit instead of being able to or knowing who you can hit and strategically send your teammates there, if you, granted, you know, you'd have to have teammates for that to happen, is an advantage over having a team, frankly, like Bronx Science, that could send its 80 million member horde out to see every single round. But again, that's, I guess, a discussion for another day.
Well, why don't we make that
there? I was
being
facetious.
Oh, ouch. Now I feel ridiculous. Can we please edit that out?
On that note.
No, we can't.
No, we're not going to edit anything out. This is... We spend our lives chortling.
That's fair. All right, Beats, are you happy you've now made a fool out of me?
We've all been fools tonight in the last hour, so I'm going to sign off for myself and for all of us, and we'll be back again next week with another view from TAB. So, gentlemen, I shall see you.
Okay.
That was good.
Okay.